Hi, and welcome to the Internet of Humans. I'm Jillian York.
And I am Konstantinos Komaitis. Our guest today is Mona Shtaya. Mona is the Campaigns and Partnership Manager and Corporate Engagement Lead at Digital Actions. She is also a non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, focusing on surveillance and digital rights in the MENA region. Additionally, she's a non-resident scholar for the Middle East Institute in the Cybersecurity and Emerging Technology Program and the Palestine-Israel Program. She previously worked as the Advocacy and Communications Manager at Seven Amlech. I hope I say this right, Mona. The Arab Center for the Advancement of Social Media, and as a Community Outreach Specialist and Social Media Specialist at Transparency Palestine, the national chapter of Transparency International. She holds an MA in Social Media and Digital Communication from the University of Westminster. Welcome, Mona.
Yes, welcome, Mona. It's great to have you with us. And Konstantinos, this is a great opportunity to really quickly dive into a funny thing before we get into more serious subjects, which is it's pronounced Hamle because the seven is actually representative of a letter in the Arabic alphabet. Mona, do you want to explain that further?
Yes, please, because I knew that I really did not pronounce this right.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, it sounds like Hamle, and Hamle is an Arabic word mean campaign. So that's how we pronounce it.
Awesome.
And in
Thank
English,
you so
it would be easier
much.
To say Hamle.
Yeah, okay. And the reason for this is the number system is to like substitute letters that don't exist in the Roman alphabet using numbers on keyboards. I remember this, you know, from living in Morocco, that it was very common for people to use it. It's called Arabizi, right?
Arabizi, yeah. It's mixing between awesome. Arabic and English, so we can have a proper language.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So let's dig in. We'll get serious now. And then we'll hopefully come back around at the end to some more light subjects. So starting with, you know, what's happening right now on the ground. Since October 7th, social media platforms have removed content from suspended accounts of Palestinian news sites, of activists, journalists, Palestinian citizens in Israel, interfering with the dissemination of news about the war and silencing critical voices. So this is not a new phenomenon, of course. You know, you and I both worked on a campaign in 2021 called Stop Silencing Palestine that called on Meta to reform various content moderation policies and practices. So right now, we're hearing platforms say that there have been glitches, we're hearing them cite security reasons and other pressure for removing posts. What are you seeing right now, and what is the impact on Palestinian voices?
Well, since you started speaking about the mysterious glitches, we as Palestinians are used to those mysterious glitches. Those glitches that only happened whenever there is escalations on the ground in Palestine. This is not a new phenomenon. This is part of a systematic efforts that happened systematically and contributes to silencing Palestinian voices. It's like we've been experiencing different forms of censorship between account suspensions, content takedown, shadow banning, among other types of censorship on different social media platforms for years now. And we've been trying to tell social media platforms to invest more in protecting people, not only Palestinians, but everyone on their platforms, and Palestinians are no different. But because we know that at any time there might be escalations. And at the first test that happened in May events in 2021, when we started that campaign, Jillian, we witnessed how there was a platform failure to protect people. We were witnessing, and we are still witnessing, disinformation, misinformation, incitement, hate speech, violent speech that has been spread all over the networks against Palestinians. Such kind of content is contributing to dehumanized labeling and stereotyping Palestinians. And this is basically contributing to normalizing anti-Palestinian racism. And that we also experience this thing on the ground where we are living this discriminatory policies on the ground. And as we all know, like digital rights are an extension for human rights from the offline space. So it's an extension for what we are living on our everyday life. Now, with the escalations since October 7th, those violations have been intensified, and we can see this information all over AI-generated content that has been published by even politicians, Israeli politicians, claiming to be real content. And social media platforms, to be honest, they are not taking proper measures to protect people on the ground, which is basically reflected to deadly attacks against Palestinians. We can see a genocide in the making in Gaza Strip and deadly attacks by Israeli settlers in the occupied Palestinian territory in West Bank. However, the impact of this kind of content has gone far beyond Palestine and Israel. We've witnessed last month a killing of a Palestinian American child in Chicago because he's Palestinian. And we've also seen an increased amount of anti-Semitic content that led also to real world harm, as the case in Tunisia, where the synagogue was burned because of this extremism and polarization on social media platforms. So this is, in a nutshell, or an overview of what's happening in Palestine right now, but we definitely gonna dive into different points whenever we are moving in this conversation.
So if I just may follow up on this, from what we are hearing from you is the fact that this has been ongoing. And as you said, right, over the past month and a half, this has intensified to the point that it's right now contributing, if you want, to the crisis in major ways. How responsive are platforms to the seriousness of this situation, you feel?
Well, it depends on how you define responsiveness, because if we're speaking about the whack-a-mole work, like reporting cases and they respond to those cases, they are doing this work. But that's not the measurements that we have been asking for so long. We are asking for policy changes that should keep everyone on those platforms safe. We are asking them to invest more resources based on the assessed risk, not on the market size, in Palestine and in other global majority countries. And those investments should aim to protect people in this part of the world, because we feel that the censorship and this kind of content, because they are not investing, for example, to combat disinformation, neither to combat incitement, hate speech, and violent speech. We're asking them for more transparency because, for example, we have been speaking to them about having Hebrew hate speech lexicon, and they said that they start, or glossary, and they notified, for example, Meta, they notified the oversight board that they achieved this goal. However, with this crisis on the ground, we figured out that there is no glossary for comments. So people are sharing insightful and hateful comments, and it stayed online, and it is contributing to the real world harm that we are exposed to. They are not really investing resources, hiring new people to improve their policies. And just like to put this in context, it is not only Palestinians. We're not alone. We are part also of other global majority countries who are struggling with social media platforms. And we know that when social media platforms have the will to do something or to protect people, they do that. Like we've seen that last year during when Russia invaded Ukraine. So whenever there's a will to do that, they can do it. However, in our case, we can't see this yet.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well. And I think we'll be seeing more on that soon. I'm curious though, we have seen some movement within the EU with Thierry Breton telling Twitter, or X as we call it now, to clamp down on disinformation. Do you think that that's a helpful move on the part of the EU?
Well, it depends on what kind of disinformation. And sometimes some legislations might be also weaponized to censor certain voices. In our case, we can see that certain legislations might be used against what's happening in Palestine. So fighting this or combating hate incitement and hate speech in general is like an ask for all of us on social media platforms. However, when it's happening for one voice and it's not happening for the other voices, then it is problematic and it is disproportionate. So we need to think about that out loud. And we need also to see how social media platforms are themselves contributing sometimes to spreading certain content that is violating their community standards. Let me give you an example. For example, at the beginning of this crisis, this ongoing crisis, Elon Musk himself, he published a tweet where he was telling people that if you want to follow up what's happening in Israel, Palestine, you should follow those two accounts. And those two mentioned accounts were basically well known for spreading disinformation previously. This tweet stayed online for 3 hours, was watched was reached around 11 million people because his account is basically followed by over 139 million people, million user. So we're speaking about, so like the senior executives are contributing by themselves to worsening the situation and to call like to let people or to call on people to follow such accounts. So this is like, if we just like take that as an example and put it in a wider context, we can also recognize how this impacted the current situation where we are now.
Yeah, and I have to admit that, you know, I was also reading a couple of things today. For instance, you know, BBC was reporting that IBM decided to pull out its advertising from X, former Twitter, because literally they were showing next to neo-Nazi content. So there is certainly a big issue there, right? And of course, if your CEO is spreading and misinformation, then it exacerbates the problem. But I want to stay a little bit more, if you don't mind, in the EU, because actually X, since we're talking about X, did something very interesting. So you know that, you know, right now we're in the process where very large online platforms like Twitter and Meta need to publish their transparency reports as part of the DSA, and they did that. And what, you know, one of the requirements was that they need to publish the number of content moderators they hire per EU language. So Twitter did that in a very weird way, but also interestingly enough, they also submitted the information for content moderators they have speaking Hebrew and Arabic. Do you think that these such data points, as we move forward, are helpful, especially if we see them in the context of the ongoing crisis right now, and considering that in Europe there are a lot of Palestinians and there are a lot of Israelis as well? So how do you see this move? Is it helpful?
Of course, it is helpful, because as much as we can get information from social media platforms, it will help us more to understand how things are moderated, and it will help us in our advocacy efforts to understand where to put more pressure. And the numbers, actually, the shared numbers by Twitter were shocking, because also if you don't look just at the Arabic and the Hebrew, look also at the difference between English and other languages. Like, we're all the time we are saying that there is higher investment when it comes to the English as a language, and if we compare that to the other languages, and this is also problematic. So if I remember correctly, the number of content moderators in Arabic were only 12, and in Hebrew were 2, I think. So it is, first of all, it is disproportionate. However, if we look even at the Arabic, like 12 content moderators, I am an Arabic speaking person. I personally can tell you that there are dialects in Arabic that I can't like literally understand a word whenever they are speaking. So 12 content moderators, I'm not sure if they will really understand the context, political context, cultural and historical context, as well as the dialect. And this is our major problem with different social media platforms, not only with X. I believe other platforms, they have higher number of moderators. However, when it comes to understanding the context, there is problems in explaining that. I can give you an example from Palestine. And May events 2021, there was a point where Meta, they have they hired the Al-Aqsa hashtag, and it was like they took this action because there was like a misunderstanding if Al-Aqsa could point out to Al-Aqsa Brigades, which is part of their DOI policy, or Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is one of the holiest places for Muslims around the world. And at that time, we lost like that content. It was like a hidden hashtag. And in the current crisis, they also took the same measure when they also decided to hide the name of what's happening. It's called Tufan Al-Aqsa or Al-Aqsa Flood. So they also hide that. So we're also speaking about misunderstanding for the context and for what's happening here. And it's not only, again, it's not only about the language, it's about dialects, it's about different cultural, political, and historical backgrounds that they need to keep in mind whenever they are moderating context, especially in high sensitive crises such as the one that we are living now.
Yeah, thanks. And I know that, Gillian, you have been saying this. So when Mona was talking about the various dialects in Arabic, literally your words came to my mind because we've been having this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is something, Mona, I mean, it's interesting because you do work on the rest of the world. And I do want to continue talking about Palestine, but I think that this is something worth noting that Arabic is one of, I mean, it's one of the most, you know, horrific examples at the moment of this disparity, but there are so many other examples elsewhere in the world where this is happening too. Is this something that you're also looking at?
Yes, of course. Like there was actually an interesting report that was published by the Localization Lab last year, mm-hmm. where they were highlighting also not only like the content moderators, like how even social media platforms, whenever they are translating their policies, it's like whenever you are reading that in another languages, it's not as much clear as when you read it in English, because it's the original language that has been written. And we do understand that it was written in English. But whenever you are translating that, translate that in a proper way. So people in those different contexts in global majority countries, where we're not speaking about now, like we're not speaking about or that report. Didn't like speak about minorities' language. We're speaking about Arabic. We're speaking about Spanish. Like a whole continent is speaking Spanish. Like Arabic, the whole like region is speaking Spanish, Arabic. So we're speaking about widely spread languages. So they need to invest it properly so people would understand their community standards, their policies. They can appeal whenever there's a violation. And even they can argue and understand the policy itself and how is that and how could that impact them whenever they are reading that. Because if they are global platforms, then they should keep the inclusivity in mind whenever they are crafting their policies so people can understand what's going on.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is something that we're seeing with the DSA. And I'm hoping that, you know, through the work of like the DSA Human Rights Alliance and other efforts that we're going to see, you know, some equality, coming from the platforms to the rest of the world. Konstantinos, I think you had a question. You had a great question coming up about infrastructure.
So yes, Mona, one of the things that, you know, I am looking at as part of my work is really trying to ensure that the infrastructure of the internet remains to the extent that it can remain intact in the sense that, you know, it's still open and decentralized and interoperable and all that. And I know that Palestine and Palestinian users have been subjected to, you know, infrastructure, better yet, has been used as one of the means to attack Palestinians and Palestinian users, you know, going back to, you know, the restrictions on 3G, for instance, that Israel at some point imposed as far back as 2015. I can only imagine, because we are reading about other infrastructure that currently is facing issues, right? Hospitals and basic and fundamental needs, electricity and clean water and all that. So what is the situation right now with connectivity and internet access in Palestine? Do you know, are people able to use any form of communication, you know, can they communicate online? How can they communicate online? What is the situation?
I'm still thinking, where should I start? Like, you were speaking and I was like, should I start from the historical context or should I start from the fact that for the past 24 hours, there has been communication blackout in Gaza Strip because the Palestinian telecoms company has been alarming people on the social media platforms and telling everyone that they are, for the past week, that they are running out of a fuel. And they said by 16th of November, if we didn't get extra fuel, then we won't be able to work. Yesterday, around this time, they ran out of fuel and they announced officially that they don't have any connectivity there. So there is now, we are now speaking while there is a communication blackout in Gaza Strip. And I'm literally like, feel sad because like in the morning I was trying to call my friends just to check if I can reach out to any of them in Gaza Strip and I was unable to reach any of them and I don't know how they are doing there. And this is not a new tactic. This is not something new. We're lagging behind the world from before October 7th with our connectivity. Since Oslo Accords, Palestinians were meant to take over the internet, the ICT infrastructure in Palestine. However, the Israeli authorities kept that under their control. And they are depriving Palestinians of accessing affordable, high quality and safe internet. And so far, we're still using in the West Bank the 3G, the third generation of the internet till today. And in Gaza Strip, before this crisis happened, they were still using the second generation of the internet. So this is just like to give someone who's hearing us and who doesn't know what's happening there. Like the communication blackout, it's not something new. It's been going there. I've been to Gaza. I've tried the second generation of the internet and I can't tell you, like you can't use it. Like even the 3G, because I travel a lot, like it's disastrous. And we, during the pandemic, we've witnessed like literally so much difficulties because our work, our like learning process, everything was online and we're lagging behind the world. So it's affecting us every day. But in the current crisis, it's even risking people's lives because whenever you don't have any kind of communication, you can't even call the civil defense to come take you from under the rubble. Like you can't even call the medical aid or the ambulance to come help your family if there's something happening there. So we're speaking about the worst situation that I can ever imagine, where people can't even ask for help from under the rubble.
That's horrific. And, you know, to see it as something where the internet has been sort of seen as the great equalizer for so many people, to deny people access to communications, to, you know, to basic infrastructure like that is terrifying. I hesitate to use this as a transition to talk about some of your other work, but I do think that there are echoes of what you're saying in some of the other work that you're doing as well. So, you know, continuing along that thread with the internet as the great equalizer, as kind of a leveler of the playing field, 2024 is the year of democracy, as you mentioned earlier to us. And I know that your work with Digital Action is looking at disinformation and elections in 2024 around a number of different countries, mostly in the global majority, but not entirely. Tell us more about that work and what are you seeing?
Well, since we were discussing the lack of investment in Palestine, Palestine is a small fraction of the whole world. Like the lack of investment is not only limited for Palestinians or in our geographic area. It's happening in other global majority countries. And over the next year, there's supposed to be over 65 elections around the world. Some of them in one of the biggest democracies in the world. We're speaking about the EU, the US, Mexico, India, and some of them are literally like happening in where oppressive regimes are controlling like such as Egypt or like that's happening basically next month, not in 2024, or many other places and the global majority countries. So our basically campaign and our coalition that has over 170 experts and organizations from 55 countries around the world are working together on 2024 Year for Democracy campaign, where we are basically trying to advocate for or to shed the light on the tech harms on elections and democracy around the world. And we're calling on social media platforms to protect people and elections, not big tech. And just to think out loud, like those inequalities that we are seeing whenever we are speaking about like tech harms and the lack of investment from social media platforms are reflecting the global equity crisis that we are living on everyday life. So we're not speaking about exceptional case. We're speaking about like a global equity crisis where global majority countries are lagging behind, where those emerging technologies that have been emerged in global North countries and legislated in global North countries are serving there, because there is also a system of legislations that serve those companies. But when it comes to the global majority countries, there is a lack of investment. Social media platforms has been flooded with disinformation, with hate speech, with gender-based violence during elections, defaming campaign, privacy issues, doxing for women who are running for elections in different places around the world. I can think about cases in Iraq and in Tunis where women elections, like where women candidates basically in Iraq were withdrawing their candidacy because of defamation campaign, and other political activists in Tunis basically were forced to leave the country because of doxing and sharing their private information on social media platforms. And they were basically exposed to trial, to be like to killing tries from different people who are basically pro-regime there. So we're speaking about major threats. We're not speaking about minor issues here and there. We're speaking about risking people's lives in different countries around the world. And we're still asking for this investment to be done properly based on the assessed risk, again, not the market size.
So I think that when I hear you speak, Mona, I realize more and more that the complexity of when we are thinking about what the Global South or countries in the Global South need, that, you know, there is so many things. When we talk about investment, for instance, it's not just investing on, you big platforms need to have content moderators in my language, but it really goes all the way down, right, to starting from infrastructure, creating those reliable and resilient networks that are able to support these communications, because these networks will actually allow also local people to use them, right, and contribute. They can become the hackers that actually can help people and navigate the situation. And that, to me, is what is so very frustrating when I hear you talking about the current situation in Palestine and how infrastructure has been weaponized against the users and the citizens. Can I ask you something? How... and I don't know whether this question will even make any sense. In my head, it really does. But what is the, you know, on the ground right now, are there Palestinian engineers that are trying to, you know, to navigate the challenges of connectivity and inform people? Because, you know, internally, what is happening, of course, there is, you know, you've mentioned the word, there is a dangerous danger, right? Because you're not able to actually call people and seek for help. But even for us, that we are outside and we really want to get that information, because that information needs to stay, right? What is happening right now needs to remain in the history as a reminder of what not to happen. Is there any way that the information can travel outside of Palestine right now?
So since the beginning of this crisis, there has been some initiatives here and there to try to connect people through eSIM cards, and some others have been issuing statements calling on Starlink to be working in Gaza Strip. And we've seen that famous tweet by Elon Musk when he said that he can connect international humanitarian workers in Gaza Strip, but not the normal people there. And we also, we're part of that, Jillian and myself, where there was also a petition now is calling on the Egyptian government to open their services for people in Gaza Strip. So there are some initiatives here and there. However, if we ask our friends in Gaza about how practical is that, like when I ask my friends about the eSIM card and if it's working properly or not, one of my friends, she's like, yeah, they didn't kill me so far, but if I'm using my eSIM, I should go up to the rooftop. And if I'm there, I'm going to definitely be shot. So you're going to lose me either way. So you should choose how do you want to lose your friend. So this is exactly the answer that I got from my friend. And literally I'm telling that when it's hard to tell such things, but it's not a joke. It's happening there. So people's life is at risk. And those alternative solutions, such as the eSIM cards, could be working to some extent, but why people should be struggling to get their basic fundamental right to connectivity while they should be able to connect and to tell what's happening there, and at least to have normal calls with their beloved ones and with their friends.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we created the internet to be resilient for those very reasons, right? For in times of conflict, people are able to use it without being afraid. And right now, what you're describing is that they cannot even use that, and they need to use basic connectivity and put their lives in danger. And yeah, that is, Jillian, please go ahead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I just think it's worth stating, you know, plainly that it's quite frustrating to see, you know, the efforts that different companies, especially from the US, have gone to in the past. I mean, we saw when Egypt shut down the internet in 2011, we saw lots of efforts from US companies to try to find a way in. You know, I'm thinking of efforts like Speak to Tweet. I mean, these are very old things. We saw, you know, Elon Musk put forward Starlink when it comes to Ukraine. And I know he'd said something about doing so in Palestine and then backed down on that, probably under pressure related to U.S. regulations around terrorism. But, you know, I mean, I think that this is, you know, Palestinians, it feels like Palestinians are very alone in this right now, and that it is exceptional compared to the ways that other conflicts have been treated. And I just want to make sure that we're saying that here. That said, I am going to shift slightly to a different question, unless, Mona, you want to add anything to that. I don't know if any of the companies are listening, but given everything that you've spoken about, I mean, everything that we've talked about so far, do you have like a wish list, a top three asks, for example, to platforms right now?
Yeah, of course. So we always have asks to social media platforms. And I think our main ask basically that we should all the time keep asking for is more transparency about how they are running things, how what investment they have done to protect us. Like, we haven't heard so far about any proper measurements or anything that has been taken into consideration to protect people on the ground. Social media platforms should be transparent about the relationships with the government and the requests that they are receiving. And this is not only for Palestine, this is globally. And should those piece of information about the relationship between social media platforms and governments should be transparent, among other things, regarding their investments. So this transparency is a key, I would say. And under transparency, we have different kind of things, such as invest more resources. And when I say resources, it's not only content moderation. Resources could be in different ways and in different forms to understand what's happening and to act properly or adequately to protect people on the ground, to combat disinformation and to prevent incitement, hate speech and violent speech of being flooded on social media platforms. And also to do this, they should develop glossaries effective glossaries to be used on those platforms. So whether that is for posts or comments or stories or whatever, they should do their work and So civil society is always ready to engage with social media platforms to make sure that they are doing a proper job to protect people on the ground. And if we want to have like a third ask for social media platform, I would personally think about having really an open, free, fair digital space for everyone. Like we've seen how the threshold of hostile speech was for Palestinians on Meta's on Instagram 25%. However, to the rest of the region during this crisis, like including Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, Syria, and Egypt, they put that, it was 80%, and then they put it on 40%. So why Palestinians should be on 25% of threshold, however, other people are on 40%. So just have like equal and an open space for everyone should be helpful, especially Palestinians see social media platforms as an open or as a chance, especially in light of the unfair coverage from the international mainstream media of what's happening here on the ground.
So hearing you speak, Mona, what is really distressing me is really that you're asking for the bare minimum and basic stuff, right? That I, as an internet user, take for granted, frankly, living in Europe. And I think that if you put it into this context, it just, you know, your mind sort of explodes. We are on time, and I really want, I mean, Gillian and I have this thing that when we're discussing the podcast, we said we always need to finish on a positive note. And we came up with this question that we ask all our guests. So here it is. What is your favorite internet human moment?
It's yet to come, but it is when everyone would be able to share whatever they want safely and freely and in a just space, if that makes sense.
That's beautiful.
Oh, it makes total sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I think that's what we wish for too.
Yes. Mona, what a pleasure. Thank you so very much for coming to talk to us about this.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really appreciate it and for helping us navigate this situation and understand better because, you know, it's really terrible what is happening. Thank you so very much. And to everyone, until next time.